examples of the politics of solidarity, of broad identification and class-wide demands that have emerged. And then I'm going to turn it over to Larry, who's going to talk about expressions of a more defensive and narrow set of responses, as well as how the pandemic has complicated how we characterize responses as either defensive or solidaristic. So to start by talking about cultures of solidarity, as I said at the top, you know, all unions experience or face a tension between broad and narrow commitments, between broad and narrow identities, strategies, and organizational forms. And, you know, this was this idea of culture of solidarity was one that was developed by Rick Fantasia. And in that book, where he's looking at the factors that shape working class consciousness in the United States, he talked about how associational forms and the culture and practices that go with them shape how workers think, feel, and act in relation to others. So obviously, on the one hand, the common experience of exploitation under capitalism potentially unifies workers. But we can't forget that unions represent only fragments of the working class. And so unions crystallize around those particularities. And this reality creates important pulls towards narrow and exclusive identities, priorities, and practices. And in their chapter in the first edition of Rethinking, Swartz and Worskitt highlight four key aspects of the state of affairs for unions under capitalism that pull towards the narrow and towards the exclusive. So they talk about sectionalism, which in which unions represent the particular interests of immediate members rather than the working class as a whole. Economism, in which unions tend to seek economic rather than political solutions for members' problems and confine their activity to the economic or the workplace terrain. The separation of the economic and the political, which is sort of a false separation under capitalism, a separation that invisibilizes the power behind economic arrangements, and which in fact is reinforced by our labor law and internalized in the union movement's structures, its capacities, its training, its consciousness, and that this separation of these two realms, define certain strategies as appropriate for workplace struggle and others for politics. And that's also often reflected in the division of labor that exists between unions and political parties that are said to speak on behalf of working people. And then finally, you know, another factor that continues to reproduce potential exclusive and divisive identities is the dynamism of capitalism itself. That capital is always reorganizing production, and hence it is always rewriting the situation of working classes out of which organizing takes place, always creating new divisions amongst workers, variegating the experiences that they have, and therefore presenting those kinds of obstacles, new obstacles that organizations have to overcome. However, moments of crisis or changing circumstances always present opportunities for rethinking and renegotiating those union cultures of solidarity and the identities and practices that go with them. For instance, the Great Depression of the 1930s created conditions in which mass numbers of people experienced poverty and dislocation and forged the industrial unions that expanded ideas of who was a worker and therefore who could and should be included in the labor movement. So it was a moment where the previous quite exclusive culture of solidarity based on craft unionism was renegotiated, was really broken through and replaced by a much more expansive one, even though that culture also had its real limitations. And, you know, Swartz and Worskitt review a number of such moments in the 20th century. And so even though, as Brian said off the top, you know, the last 40 years have been one of difficulty, there are all that and also of defensiveness on the part of the labor movement, there have also always been moments through that period where there have been opportunities to rethink and expand the union culture of solidarity to be more inclusive, to be more political, to be more focused on class-wide organizing and class-wide demands. So in the chapter that Larry and I wrote for this volume, we argue that the COVID-19 pandemic has been another such moment, a mass experience of crisis that has interrupted not only the routines of life, but really the basis of production and social reproduction on a very fundamental level. And as such, because of that mass experience of disruption, has created an opportunity for cultures of solidarity and the organizations and strategies that go with it to be renegotiated. However, it's important to note that that renegotiation can have lots of potential outcomes. So that renegotiation can lead to more inclusive or more exclusive identities and politics in the labor movement. So moving on to talk a little bit more specifically about the aspects of the pandemic that have created conditions that might broaden solidarity or might narrow it. In the chapter, we discuss five major elements that, of course, there may be more, but we identify, focus on five major elements that we argue have shaped the terrain of pandemic labor politics. So first is really the emergence of, in March 2020 and in the months that followed, mass unemployment and the shared experience of economic dislocation that resembled, although it did not reach the levels of the Great Depression, and frankly raised some radical questions about whether people should have to rely on wages and employment for their survival. Right, that issue was renewed in public discourse, and we had to find ways to ensure people's reproduction, social reproduction, without being able to access employment. That created a certain set of openings. More recently, however, we see the emergence of labor shortages in particular sectors, and that some workers are more able to exert leverage in that situation than others. And that's an issue that Larry's going to talk on a little bit more later. The second major area of crisis that creates an opening is that we have all collectively lived through a crisis of care and of social reproduction in which the contradictions surrounding the paid and unpaid labor of women, of racialized women in particular, and of particular groups of public sector workers that make it possible for society and profit making to continue, that the kicking out from under of the conditions that make that work possible were really laid bare, and our collective inability to function without their labor became much more obvious, and again creating an opening for a new and broader politics of connection and solidarity across these different experiences. There's been, thirdly, a widespread crisis in occupational health and safety, which has touched vast numbers of workers, in which not only people have been exposed to workplace hazards in a new and unprecedented way, but in which the political nature of occupational health and safety, the fact that it is shot through with power relations and not just a technical problem or exercise to solve through, you know, inspections and, you know, WMIS, etc., that its political nature became much more evident in the pandemic. Employer power over workplace organization and hence worker safety became much more obvious, if it wasn't obvious to people before, and was also reinforced by the fact that government inspectors basically helped employers to keep people working in unsafe conditions. And so that presented an opportunity for politicization and cooperation across many different groups within the working class. Working from home has been another common experience, but again, with important varying impacts. For some, the impact has been very negative, given their multiple overlapping conflicting responsibilities that are all converging in one place, the home. For others, we have to admit it's been a boon, and has allowed some people, because of privilege, to benefit, but also for some people, it has allowed them to escape oppressive and racist work cultures, frankly. So, you know, the impact of working from home is both unifying and dividing at the same time. Overall, I would say that isolation and the collapse of being together at work has eroded social ties that are essential for solidarity, and those aspects are going to have to be significantly re-established and rethought if we ever move into a post-pandemic period. Fifth, the pandemic has also highlighted an important difference between essential work and essential workers. And I would say at the beginning of the pandemic, I think many of us were very optimistic about the way that it seemed like there was a collective revaluation of workers in particular occupations that had previously been either maligned or invisible or relegated to the margins of the labor market, but that now were seen, understood to be essential, and that we actually needed to not just appreciate them, but make sure that they were well paid and protected. But, you know, there was that hope for improved status, I would say, evaporated very quickly, in the sense that we soon found that what was essential was the work in the eyes of employers and governments, and that the workers were expected to make their bodies available no matter the consequence to them. And so as Gardner, Maximball, and Togohan argue in the chapter on migrant workers in this book, this dichotomy was especially acute for migrant workers, who were both essential and disposable, and whose racialization made their extreme exposure to risk in order to keep the rest of us fed acceptable, quote unquote. And so, whereas essentiality could be, you know, for a moment could be a unifying frame, differences also emerged in how essentiality could be turned into leverage or bargaining power or not on behalf of particular groups of workers. So, despite some important shared experiences of hardship, not everyone experienced the pandemic in the same way, and this differentiation is the central terrain on which the labor movement and individual unions, cultures, and politics of solidarity are going to be experienced in years to come. So let me now talk briefly about some of the examples of expanded politics of solidarity that emerged from these dynamics that I've just been talking about. And I'm going to talk just about three. I'm sure that there are more, but we note three. First, the shared experiences of the collapse of work and of social reproduction led to renewed and new demands for universal state programs, and not for solutions resting in particular workplaces or collective agreements. And I think that's important. This included rethinking income supports, employment insurance, social protections and programs, employment standards, especially demands for permanent paid sick days, universal child care, pharmacare, renewed investment in health care, in long-term care, national regulation of long-term care. In some ways, the pandemic, I think, we argue, led to a renewed demand to expand the welfare state in a way that resonated beyond the groups that had throughout the last 40 years been calling to preserve or expand the welfare state. There was some fertile ground on which those demands could be found. And in fact, you know, we can talk about later what progress we've made on those items, but I think we can see that there are some important potential areas of progress on these demands that are potentially universalizing. The second area that we note that indicate expanded politics of solidarity has to do with a renewed attention to the implications of racism and the racialization of work and labor markets in Canada, and the very public and clearly uneven experiences of risk being taken by racialized workers in particular, you know, in conjunction with the experiences of Black people in particular, and also Indigenous people in Canada, of racist policing practices, that renewed attention to intersections of work with racial justice, racial economic justice, found its way to the center of public discourse, and many labor organizations attempted to center those demands for racial economic justice in their programs. Although I will note that you know, the contribution that Winnie Ng and Carol Wall make to this book raises some important questions about the depth and seriousness with which labor organizations are pursuing that. Nonetheless, there was the potential and some important gestures towards a politics of solidarity on the basis of addressing the needs and interests of those who are the most marginalized and within workplaces, labor markets, and also unions. And then finally, we saw renewed calls for nationalization of key industries and conversion of manufacturing capacity to produce socially necessary goods in the face of a lack of domestic capacity to produce protective equipment, personal protective equipment, and vaccines. So, you know, while people have been having conversations about, you know, the need for an interventionist industrial strategy for a long period of time, the pandemic actually created an opening to have a larger conversation about industrial strategy that meant something different in the context of the pandemic, and, you know, connected also with how we will collectively deal with the crises of climate change, the need to decarbonize the economy, and ensure a just transition to an environmentally sustainable system of production post-pandemic, should we ever reach that day. And so those are the things that we note that have expanded the discourse of the labor movement and have framed the labor movements, those aspects of the labor movement that have pursued a broader politics of solidarity. Now I'll turn it over to Larry to talk about those aspects that are reinforcing a more defensive or narrow politics.
Thanks, Steph. So for the rest of the presentation, we're going to talk about the flip side and then complicate things a little more. Because while the times may have called for a more solidaristic politics, some unions were more predisposed to narrower conceptions of solidarity in formulating the responses to the pandemic. And this was made clear by the emphasis on sectionalist over universal demands. What we found was that narrow and more defensive responses were more likely in unions whose memberships were more exposed to the consequences of the pandemic. And to be clear, this is completely understandable given that unions are expected to defend member interests. However, in framing those defenses, the decision to pursue sectionalist framings and demands really represented a lost opportunity to build broader coalitions, in our view. So some unions, in concert with employers, called for reopenings as the solution to job loss, even as infection and hospitalization rates were increasing. And let me use Unifor as an example here. While that union made a whole host of very good broad-based, class-based demands, it also advocated for sector-specific bailouts and even reopenings of airlines and casinos back in the fall of 2020, long before mass vaccinations and despite being on the brink of a third wave. Again, while Unifor's efforts to protect the jobs of its members is understandable, it also demonstrates a lack of broader solidarity with immunocompromised working class people. You know, to put it another way, the union's primary focus on employment as the solution rather than on income supports that would allow union members to stay home, put people at risk in unequal ways from a public health perspective. Again, none of this is to suggest the union's concern for the long-term viability of important sectors of the economy is not a pressing issue, but it does say something about the union's conception of solidarity, that its interests are more aligned with the corporate entities that employ its members than with the most vulnerable segments of the working class. And I don't want to pick on Unifor specifically, they certainly weren't alone in pursuing sectionalist strategies. You know, another example from Ontario is probably the Nurses Association, which played a very central role in fighting the pandemic. But ONA also demonstrated strong sectionalist impulses by campaigning for exemptions or specific protections to the exclusion of other essential workers. And here I want to draw on the example of ONA's campaign to exempt its members from Bill 124, which is the Ontario government's wage restraint legislation. And before I mount this criticism, I want to be very clear that we think that ONA was right to frame the application of Bill 124 as a gender equity issue, given that male-dominated firefighters and police were granted exemptions. However, even if nurses had been granted a similar exemption to Bill 124, the majority of public sector workers still covered by the bill would be women. So while a campaign to exempt nurses from wage restraint legislation is good for nurses, it does very little, in fact, to help women who work in education, social services, or other public sector jobs. Rather than calling for Bill 124's repeal for everyone as an opportunity to put forward a universal demand through inclusive and solidaristic political messaging, ONA instead retreated to both sectionalism and legalistic justifications for its own strategic approach. Arguably, that choice only served to divide public sector unions when they needed to be united in order to resist the provincial government's austerity agenda. Of course, we know that ONA's campaign so far has been unsuccessful, and it's maybe worth considering what would have happened if instead ONA had leveraged healthcare hero discourse and high levels of public sympathy to strike in order to defeat the bill for nurses and for all public sector workers. You know, historically, nurses' strikes have been quite successful, and it occurs to me that the window of opportunity to launch a successful strike with strong public support may have been open for some time. I think that the fact that nurses didn't pursue that option points to maybe some enduring attachments to legal strategies rather than the use of direct action. And I'm not just talking about nurses here. Teachers' unions also retreated to legal strategies in contesting things like work refusals and a return to in-class instruction. We did not see many instances of direct action in that sector either, or in any sector, quite frankly. Steph, could I ask for the next slide? We have Steph's controlling the slides for us. Thanks. Now, I want to complicate things a little more, because, of course, solidaristic and defensive strategies are not watertight compartments. It's important, I think, to acknowledge that defensive politics can be framed as solidaristic and vice versa. It's not a clear dichotomy. What it means to be broad and inclusive or narrow and exclusive can depend on your vantage point. For example, is it solidaristic or defensive for a union to take the position that no worker should be fired for refusing to be vaccinated? This is not always clear, and vaccine mandates, in our view, have been very disorienting for the labor movement. You know, some unions, like the ATU local in Toronto and police unions, have been actively resisting employer and state-led efforts to impose vaccine mandates, while other kinds of unions, like faculty associations at universities, took the lead in pressuring employers to impose vaccine mandates, or, like Unifor, they sort of played a role in lowering workers' expectations that the union would go to the wall for members who refused to be vaccinated out of personal preference. And these dynamics, I acknowledge, are complicated, and that's in part because unions are programmed to defend workers' rights and to push back against unilateral employer action. I think it's in unions' DNA to be suspicious of employer initiatives, even if arguably the employer initiative works to protect the majority of the workers or community health more broadly. In many ways, unions were faced with the worst of both worlds. They were attacked by unvaccinated members who wanted their jobs defended, and they were attacked by vaccinated members who wanted their health protected. The takeaway here is that union responses are not easily categorized as solidaristic or defensive. It really does depend on one's perspective in the workplace. A similar example is with the invoking of the Emergencies Act. You know, the convoy of course was universally condemned by the labor movement, but union responses to the invoking of the Emergency Act, they ranged from tepid support to careful opposition. Again, on this issue, what it means to be broad and inclusive or narrow and exclusive really depends on your vantage point. Maybe it depends on whether you lived in downtown Ottawa or not. You know, I think we have to ask the question, though, is it solidaristic or defensive to take the position that the Emergency Act should be invoked or should have been invoked? And these are debates that I think are taking place and will continue to take place within unions. Now, you might ask, how do we account for these different positions on vaccines or civil liberties? It's not always clear. You know, we've talked a lot about this, in fact. You know, does it reflect different union cultures? Is it about a legalistic versus political approach to these questions? Is it a question of bread and butter unionism versus a social justice culture? Is there something about macho occupational culture in some unions that lends itself to a particular kind of politics? Or is it the individual views of particular leaders of particular unions in particular moments of time? It may be a mix of these things, and certainly there may be other reasons, and we would love to hear your views as part of the Q&A. We are very curious about this particular dynamic. Now, to conclude, I think we conclude that it's probably too early to tell if the economic and the political turmoil caused by the pandemic will ultimately end up expanding Canadian unions' culture of solidarity, or will it narrow as unions retreat to defensive, sectionalist, and economistic responses? I think for Stephanie and I, at the beginning of the pandemic, we were much more optimistic about the possibilities for a broader solidaristic politics. But at this point in the pandemic, we're a little more pessimistic because the particular window of opportunity presented by the pandemic now seems to be closing. You know, that said, it's clear that variations in both the experience of the pandemic and union cultures are going to continue to pull many unions towards narrow and defensive responses. And given this, many on the left are desperately searching for clues that might help steer the labor movement towards broader cultures of solidarity. And hopefully during the discussion, people can help point to those hopeful openings and we can have some discussion about how we turn things around. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, thank you so much. so much. So we'll start the question period now. And again, so you can use the raise hand function or submit a question through the chat. There's your eye at the bottom of your Zoom screen. You'll see some icons. One of them is the reaction button. If you click it, you'll see the option to raise your hand if you would like to do that. We had a question that was already submitted, so I'll just start off with that question, which was, how can we leverage the level of CRB that was given as a minimum weekly income that then that should be included into minimum wage legislation?
Shall I take that, Lara? I mean, I'm not sure I have a good answer for that, only to say that a few things. One is that, you know, there's that CERB and CRB, which came after, you know, are showed that it is possible to provide people with income that is, you know, superior to the forms of social assistance that we've been distributing thus far. And there's indications that even though CERB and CRB were quite meager, they were certainly not a living wage, that they did contribute to, for instance, a reduction in the rate of child poverty for the first time in tens of many years. And that there is something to be said about how access to that income without having to prove your worthiness, which is like a key element of social assistance programs, did make a big difference to people's life, made the difference between getting through the pandemic and not. But that being said, like in terms of what leverage we might use to integrate that into demands for higher minimum wage, I just would say that, you know, that's a tricky item because, again, remember that the minimum wage depends upon you accessing employment. So, of course, you know, we want to fight for a higher minimum wage, but it isn't a panacea because there will still be people who aren't able to work. And as such, they're going to be left out of any kind of politics that increases the minimum wage. But I think clearly the experience of CERB shows that, you know, approaching a living wage is not only possible, but makes a concrete material difference to people's lives. But I think that, you know, the forces that are fighting around minimum wage, living wage, basic income are very divided and have very different ideas about what kind of regime of income support is necessary. And I think that on that basis, it's difficult to see how like a common politics around that can really be generated right now. I think that the divisions there are very serious. And maybe Brian might want to say something about that, given that he studies living wage and minimum wage movements more directly. Anyway, I hope that answered your question. It probably didn't, but...
Okay, thank you. So just sort of to be as fair as possible, we'll try and go sort of in order as I see hands raised. So Marianne Pollack, I'll ask you to unmute your mic.
Okay, thank you very much. I find that my mind is really thinking about this. My concern is that both Larry and Stephanie have minimized how tired unions and union officials are because of the pandemic and how that tiredness has made them unable to do much. You know, unions who have members are still working during the pandemic in workplaces were spending their whole time trying to get PPE, trying to deal with basic health and safety issues. And then along came the vaccines, and unions were getting vicious calls from anti-vaxxers, yelling and screaming at them at best, and, you know, and et cetera. So I believe that many unions, and I think that this is quite widespread, I think that many unions, you know, you talked about sort of the opportunities for responses. I think that many unions were unable to respond just because they're so tired of having to deal with the day-to-day conflicts in the workplace over vaccines and the day-to-day work of keeping people safe. So I'd sort of like comments on that.
Mia, Brian, do you want us to like take maybe a few comments and then have us answer, or would that be maybe? What do you think, Larry? Yeah, let's have hear from a few more folks before we answer.
So Laurel, Richie, I'm going to ask you to unmute your mic. Laurel, I've given, if you want to ask your question.
Okay, I think that worked. Hi. I actually want to come back to the question that was raised at the outset there about using the CERB and the Canada Recovery Benefit minimum, the weekly amount of 500, then lowered to 300. As a way of leveraging the discussion around minimum wage. As somebody active in this fight, I have to say there was barely a whisper from the labor movement when they did lower the CERB benefit with the second stage to 300. With very few exceptions. I work closely with Unifor on its campaign. QP was there, and so was the CLC as the central, and some of the labor federations, though not all. It's, I think, really important to say that it was the community organizations, most notably, at least in the area I live, the Workers Action Center and the Justice for Workers campaign, but also, frankly, the community legal clinics with a lot of young and mostly racialized folks in those clinics who were assisting people in the community. And they have continued on this particular battle. As far as leveraging it, there is still an attempt to do that being carried through in the debates around where we go with employment insurance benefits, which do not have any kind of minimum, not even $300. The other example I would give is that in Quebec, with the Quebec Parental Leave Program, They didn't have a minimum benefit, but they had to introduce the 500, then 300 in the face of the federal CERB program. And just a couple of months ago, that is in January, they have now set a new minimum for the Quebec parental benefits. So they've carried forward, if you will, a lesson out of the COVID experience. So I think that's the kind of thing we need to see more of. I haven't heard anybody generate a discussion around minimum wage, but I'm glad to hear it being raised. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. And Alan Ernst, I'm going to ask you to unmute your mic so you can ask your question.
Hi, Stephanie and Larry. Thanks very much for your presentation, and nice to meet you virtually, if not in person. One thing I pretty much very much like the presentation. One thing I'd be interested in knowing is hearing how you view what is the sort of the much hyped and perhaps U.S.-specific great resignation in the context of labor and union activity, and that may more non-union workers. My general sense, and I've been following it closely, is that there may be some limited uptick in union activity and organizing, but I don't get a great sense of success. And then in terms of an overall strategy and response, it certainly strikes me as very much a temporary, likely temporary phenomenon, and certainly one that's individualized to extent that it's resignation. But I'm just like interested in your observations on that.
Thank you. You want one more question or?
Sure.
Okay, so Jane Sinton, I'm going to ask you to unmute your mic.
Hi there. It's great to see you again, Stephanie, after so many years. And it's a great presentation. I'm finding it really, really interesting. I'm very glad I came. So I actually wanted to answer Larry's question earlier about what is it that influences union culture towards solidarity or not, at least to give my view and opinion, which in part is informed by 30 years of working at QP in the national office. And I think, you know, that sort of internal union culture is an important aspect. Actually, the mix, I guess, is the short answer. I think it's many factors. The ones that you pointed to are important. Culture has that lasting legacy. So it's hard to change. And I think in order to change it, you need a critical mass of people involved in making that change over a sustained period of time. And there's no guarantee it's not going to change back again as well. I also think the leadership is extremely important. That whole question of individual leaders at a particular time, I think is very important, that they can make a big difference about how they frame things, who they want to have hired, what they want to do in terms of campaigns. But not, it's not just individual, it's collective too. Right? I mean, you get, I think, the best leaders when they've got a strong base as well. And that base is pushing for change too. So it's that interactive process. Anyway, thank you. And it's great to see you all.
So nice to see you too, Jane. Jane and I went to school together and probably haven't seen each other for 20 years, so it's really nice. I'll answer a couple of things. And I don't know what, Larry, what you want to answer, but... I'll just start with Marion's observation that union leaders are tired, and that's why we maybe see what we're seeing, and that we should be more forgiving. And I think that's a very fair point. And I think that that the number, the complexity, and the vitriolic nature of the current environment on a whole host of issues makes it enormously difficult, even if you're trying your very best, to do just the basics of union leadership, let alone engage in the kind of broader and more visionary types of politics that we're talking about. So I appreciate that intervention, but I think that we get to the same place, which is that even if it's true that the reasons why the labor movement has been kind of on the defensive is because of this onslaught, we still see the same outcome. And I would say partly it's because when you're in crisis, you go to habits. You go to the things that you know how to do. You go to the things that are comfortable to do. And I think we have to acknowledge that there are some certain institutional, organizational defaults in the labor movement that despite maybe, you know, a collective desire for something else, something better, something broader, something more political, you know, is the go-to when you're in crisis. And I think that compounding that, so that means like a reliance on like sort of the tried and true forms of service unionism, you know, grievance handling, all of that kind of stuff that Larry talked a little bit about. But I think also you know, the fact that our movements tend to be run by activists, a very small layer of activists, is also a real issue. And when the demands become so intense, the weakness of that becomes more evident, where you only have a small number of people who are really keeping the fire going. And in a crisis, you hope, okay, people are going to get involved. Well, of course, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, it's likely to be the opposite. So I don't think we disagree, Marian, but I think ultimately I'd say, like, we get to the same place. We get to the same sort of politics of defensiveness, and I think we still have to figure out a way out of it then. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would comment on is the Great Resignation, which is a really, I think, an important thing to try to grapple with. I mean, you know, I have to confess, I haven't really followed the sort of the statistical dimensions of this, like how many people are quitting, whatever. I don't want to give you the impression that I'm up to date on that, but my sense is that the Great Resignation is very sectorally specific, and that it also represents like you have to have certain kinds of a certain kind of personal safety net in order to be able to quit.
Yeah.
And to be able to use that as an individual exit option. And then I think that's what it is. It is an important signal that people are fed up with work and work under these conditions, but it is not a collective response. It is an individual exit response. And it does, I think, indicate that our movements are not capitalizing on this collective discontent. And, you know, insofar as the Great Resignation is perhaps, in, you know, I think we noted it as, you know, affecting the restaurant industry in particular. I mean, we don't have unions in the restaurant industry in any significant way. And so how do you, when you don't have a collective organization, there's nothing there to capture and channel that discontent in forms of collective action that can actually make a difference. And so, of course, it's the quit right now. It is important to note that there is a wave of some kind of organizing in the U.S. You know, Starbucks, there is a wave of organizing in Starbucks. It's very interesting. It's hopeful. But, I don't want to rain on that parade. I think it's an important potential breakthrough. But it still is only about 100 stores in the context of a chain of 9,000 outlets. So, you know, I don't want to get too overexcited about it. So, you know, I think that there are, my sense of the Great Resignation is that it is an important signal, but up to now, I don't think that the movement has really kind of self-consciously taken advantage of what it says about people's discontent with work and channeled it in any kind of meaningful collective way.
Maybe just to add to this, I won't add on that the last point that Stephanie made, but on this, the question of tiredness and the labor leadership, I mean, I don't know if the response to tiredness is to retreat to familiar patterns, and, or in this particular case, not actually use what arguably are the most effective tools in the tools box, which is the right to withdraw labor. It's not lost on us that in 2015, the Supreme Court declares a constitutional right to strike, and then ever since, the days lost to labor disputes has declined. In other words, you get a constitutional right to strike, and then you decide we're going to use it less and less, is a bit odd. And of course, this predates the pandemic. Right? It's, you know, 2016 they were down, 2017 they were down, 2018, 2019 they were down. Of course, they almost hit the bottom during the first wave of the pandemic. And who knows what kind of uptick we'll see as people decide that the way that they have to play catch up is actually through withdrawing your labor. And I don't know that I'm too sympathetic to this argument about tiredness, because I think that the times actually called for more militancy, and certainly those windows of opportunity existed in certain sectors, in particular in the economy, where I think that that labor may have missed out. Because when we talk about labor politics, you know, people immediately think about the ballot box and elections, but labor politics, of course, is far more broad than that. It's what happens in the workplace and through coalitions, etc. I see that there's a bunch of people with their hand up, though, so I don't want to keep this up, and I'm happy to have it keep going in the Q&A.
Sure. So, Helen Prenford, I'll ask you to unmute your mic.
Thank you very much for taking my question and comment. I am an educator and was the provincial president of the Federation of Women Teachers Associations of Ontario. And I'm interested in the comment that you made, Larry, about education and educators retreating to legal actions. And I would like to just make a comment that I would like you to address. Do you think that with the pandemic, governments, particularly in Ontario, but perhaps in other parts of Canada, have used this as an opportunity to move towards more privatization of education and certainly more online learning of education? And I believe, my personal opinion,
I think so,
is this would have a very detrimental effect on education in Ontario and Canada. Would you comment, please?
I'm happy to comment, but I think we should take a few comments and then Stephanie and I will respond to a few of them at a time.
Great, thank you. Okay, Sarah Fowler, I'm going to ask you to unmute your mic.
Hi, am I unmuted? No. Hi, thank you so much. So I'm from Ontario originally, but I've been in BC for some time now. And my question, just sort of to compare my two experiences, is there any sort of like high level general labor market numbers about where the line is between unionized work forces and non-unionized workforces? Like you mentioned, servers, farm workers, those are non-unionized jobs. I myself am an elected official, also non-unionized. It's not even a real job, to just put that out there. It's doesn't come under WorkSafe boundaries. It doesn't come under any of these things. And so it's hard to recruit, you know, because I can't really always highlight the benefits, except generalized benefits like democracy. And, you know, if you don't participate, then who is it really going to serve? But because I have, you know, grown up in Ontario with two labor or union parents who had union jobs, the sort of disconnect between what I'm able to offer my family and what I was sort of given as a safe place to grow up with dental, etc., has really, you know, it's like the bottom's dropped right out. And even too, I wonder how, from Ontario to BC, how that is. But also just like, is it less than 20% unionized positions from like an entire labor market? Or just trying to give my myself what the numbers look like. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. So Adam King, I'm going to ask you to unmute your mic.
Okay, thanks, Mia, and thanks, Larry and Steph, for a great presentation. This is just sort of, maybe you can comment on this. I was wondering what you guys sort of thought about the, I don't want to say post-pandemic because we're not out of it, but post-lockdown economy. We have new, if you like, conditions that you would think would redound to the benefit of labor. We have a tighter labor market and so on, but it doesn't really seem to be showing up. It's not showing up so much in the wage data. Certainly hasn't affected union density in any way. So, you know, what accounts for this?
Okay, thank you, Adam. So we've got one more hand. So, Rabbi Solomon Schechter.
Can you tell Granny I have 6 minutes left?
Unmute your mic.
Thank you. So I live in Ontario, and I work in the healthcare sector. it does not have the right to strike. Earlier it was mentioned how come the nurses haven't struck. It's very difficult for especially in a pandemic to withdraw services when you're dealing with such greater need. But one of the reasons why wage gains haven't taken place in Ontario is not just because of Bill 124, it's also and the refusal of arbitrators to get out of their gender bias that professionals, especially men, deserve higher wage increases and lower classifications don't deserve it. I would like to mention one of the benefits of the pandemic in Ontario has been the ripping off of the veil of the terrible conditions in long-term care. Conditions of care also impact conditions of work, and that the for-profit sector has done a much worse job in protecting the public, and there are now campaigns to try and transition away from the for-profit sector in long-term care. It remains to be seen how effective will be in the election campaign and with the new federal interest in a national standard for long-term care.
Interesting.
Okay, thank you. So that's all the hands that we have up for now. So I don't know if I want to give you folks a chance to answer some questions.
What? Sure. Do you want to go first, Larry, or what do you want to do?
And just in reverse order, in response to Rabbi Shalom, who pointed out that in many cases, nurses don't have the right to strike. And in some jurisdictions in Canada, nurses do have the right to strike. But I wasn't actually making a distinction between having a legal right to strike and not having a legal right to strike. Illegal nurses' strikes have been successful in general terms in the Canadian context, and I think a little labor history here is useful. Our modern system of labor relations in the form of PC 1003 was introduced during World War II in arguably a moment of crisis when there was unprecedented labor unrest and militancy in the society in general, but in arms manufacturing in particular. Those workers used their particular position in the economy, their window of opportunity, in order to press for a political demand that they were able to win for a much broader working class. So again, when we want to compare that to nurses today and talk about maybe some particularities of arbitrators, I think we're talking about forests and the trees here, because I think that there are bigger things, no doubt riskier. I don't want to minimize that there is risk involved in direct action, in bending and breaking the law. But I think that the pandemic may have called for these wider visions about how we press class-based demands going forward. On the particular question that was asked of me in terms of the pandemic, this idea that employers were using this to push an agenda of privatization, I think that is right. It's certainly, there's some evidence of that in the university education sector, and it's certainly in primary and secondary. I don't think there's any question that a whole host of employers have used the pandemic as a cover to reorganize all sorts of work processes. You know, very much in line with Naomi Klein's thesis of shock doctrine, right? That you take this moment of crisis and you use it to your advantage to try to reorganize things. And a lot of this move towards online learning, of course, some of it was certainly in play before the pandemic, but I think it's been concretized far more, and that you're going to see employers insisting that this is the new normal and this is now a permanent feature of work. And I don't think there's any question that the pandemic helped provide some cover to push things in that direction. There's a whole other discussion, I think, to be had about the benefits or drawbacks of online learning, but I don't think there's any question that the pandemic played a role in pushing things in that direction. I'll leave it to you, Stephanie.
Well, I'll just add a couple of things. One is that it may come as a shock to people, but I do research not with Larry. And in fact, this last year, I was working with Wayne Luchuk and Peter Grafe at MAC to do a survey of Ontario workers around their experiences of the pandemic. And I just put the link to some of our findings.